The woman's stride was weary as she trudged up the hill from the river. One arm held the heavy conical jug of water on top of her head, while the other clutched the hand of a small girl. The girl pulled at her mother's hand, her bare, dirty feet slapping on the street as she skipped ahead. The woman laughed. Her daughter looked up at her, surprised at the sound. She rarely heard her mother laugh, at least these days. The girl had vague memories of a time before they had lived here, when the laughter had come more often, but those memories were hazy, like they belonged to a different person in a different life. The sun sank down in the sky to the west as the mother and daughter walked through the twisting, narrow, blessedly shadowed streets. They passed by the entrance of the vast temple of Ashur, the city's god, and glanced up at the towering crag of rock. Some people in the city said the rock was Ashur, but others said the city itself was Ashur, and she didn't understand what they meant. She had only lived in the city for a brief time, and she barely made out one word in five from the chatter she heard as they walked home, or at least to the house of her owner, a man named Manuki Ashur. Her daughter was quick and understood more, and she often translated for her mother. The woman still barely answered to the name they called her, the Naya Ila'i. It had something to do with a god, she knew, and it was good to honor a powerful deity, but it wasn't her name. None of these people spoke her language, though, and they weren't interested in her name. She was a slave, and so was her daughter. A sudden pain caused the woman to stop and gasp. It was her ankle again. She had felt it twist and pop when the soldiers had dragged her out of her home, her real home, on that awful day when they had taken her and her daughter. She still remembered the acrid stink of fire, the dead bodies and streaks of blood littering the streets, the crash of breaking pottery, and her horror when she'd seen the Assyrians smashing the statues of the gods who watched over them. The images and sounds visited her in her dreams far more often than she would prefer. The ankle had never healed properly. After a long day of carrying water and scrubbing the house and carrying flour and baskets of fruit and jugs of wine and olive oil, the pain often flared up. Nobody was interested in hearing her complaints. Not her owner, not the owner's wife, not their children. She had jobs to perform, and it didn't matter how much she hurt. That was her life. They were nearing the house of Manuki Ashur. She slowed her stride, limping on her bad ankle. Her daughter asked if she was all right, and the woman smiled down at her. She started to sing an old, soft song in the old language, one that her mother had taught her so many years before. The Assyrians couldn't take that from her. Generation after generation of kings forged the Assyrian Empire through the brutal application of force. They burned cities, tortured and executed enemy kings, slaughtered thousands, and carried off millions into captivity. Eventually, however, fortune's wheel turned, and Assyria came to suffer the same fate it had inflicted on so many others over the centuries. Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. When we think about ancient empires, we usually do so from the perspective of the imperial center in terms of kings, wars, programs of monumental building. We tend to focus on their triumphs, their conquests, the glittering cities, and the works of art they leave behind for archaeologists to find millennia later. When an empire comes to an end, that's often the climax of a sad story of decline and fall. Great palaces crumble into dust, and the glory of a past civilization sinks into obscurity, forgotten by those who come after. It's a tragedy, we're told, when these remarkable achievements are lost beneath the sands of time. But this is just one side of the story, one perspective. A growing empire in its golden age, ruled by a powerful king known to posterity as a great conqueror, would have looked much different to those people targeted for conquest than to the palace scribes who recorded the great conqueror's mighty deeds. What appears in the historical record as a conqueror's mighty deed, the king riding out with his army to conquer a state that defied the empire's obvious greatness and right to rule, seems much more like an act of wanton destruction. Empires leave behind mounds of bodies and burned cities, a trail of human and material wreckage that's only much later covered by those glittering monuments to imperial accomplishment. Plundered temples, smashed belongings, long lines of people led away into slavery, these are the obvious consequences of forging and maintaining an empire. The boastful inscriptions and admiring accounts from hangers-on that form the raw material of history obscure this reality in profound ways. The Neo-Assyrian Empire is often called the First World Empire, a dominating and unchallenged force that remade the landscape and peoples living within its borders. At its peak, it stretched from the cataracts of the Nile in Egypt to the Caspian Sea, from the rocky highlands of central Turkey to the marshy fringes of the Persian Gulf. No state had ever been larger, and all the empires that followed in this region over the next 1,500 years, Persian, Macedonian, Roman, Sassanid, and Arab, built on the material and conceptual foundations the Assyrians had built. For centuries, Assyria's kings sent out their armies to conquer territory, sack cities, and bring back plunder. Hundreds of thousands of people died. Millions were deported from their homelands as part of the Assyrian imperial project, and an unaccountable number were uprooted and carried off into slavery, separated from their families and the ways of life they'd known, turned into the movable property of the conquerors. The Assyrian kings made no secret of their brutality. Instead, they trumpeted it, boasting about severing hands from the dead as trophies and flaying captured kings alive, making precise counts of the numbers of people they deported or enslaved. And when their empire fell apart, which it did with incredible speed in the last decades of the 7th century BC, that same treatment was revisited on the Assyrian heartland in what's now northern Iraq. Today, we're going to try to understand two things. First, how people, not the kings, experienced the rule of the Assyrian Empire, and second, how the Assyrian Empire ended. Those two things are connected quite intimately. The seeds of violence and destruction that the Assyrians themselves planted in the middle of the 7th century BC blossomed into explicit revenge just a few decades later. People who had been victims of Assyrian aggression returned the favor and did so with much accrued interest. That is a substantial part of the reason why the Assyrian Empire has been, if not forgotten, then at least somewhat overlooked in comparison to the other significant territorial states in the ancient world. In the end, it was quite literally torn down, its achievements deliberately erased by those who had, until recently, been on the receiving end of the same treatment. To be clear, this is not an ethical judgment or some vague statement about the moral arc of the universe bending towards fairness. The Medes and Neo-Babylonians who were responsible for that end were hardly paragons of fine behavior themselves. It's more of an observation that the Assyrians themselves wrote the rules of this imperial game and then suffered the consequences when the shoe was on the other foot. We reap what we sow, as the saying goes, though not in the way we necessarily think. To help us understand life in the closing decades of the Assyrian Empire, we're going to need a guide to show us around. Two of them, in fact, though we only know one of their names. Nanaya-Ilai. The other person is the daughter of Nanaya-Ilai. These were both real people, and we know about them thanks to a cuneiform tablet found more than a century ago in excavations at the city of Ashur, the spiritual center and namesake of the Assyrian Empire. A quick note here, throughout this episode, when it comes to Nanaya-Ilai and her daughter, I'm relying on a 2009 paper by Bettina Feist entitled An Elamite Deportee, along with a really wonderful, relevant section of Karen Radner's Ancient Assyria, a very short introduction. Sometime between 646 and 620 BC, almost certainly closer to the beginning than the end of that period, Nanaya-Ilai and her daughter were sold as slaves, and the transaction was recorded by a scribe on that tablet. The buyer, a man named Manuki Ashur, paid the price of one mina of silver, about 500 grams, to the group of 10 men who jointly owned Nanaya-Ilai and her daughter. We're told that Nanaya-Ilai and her daughter were Elamites from the region of southwestern Iran centered around the city of Susa, that they had been taken from the land of Elam as spoils of war, and that the king had given them to the city of Ashur. We can't be certain precisely how this group of 10 men ended up making the sale. One option is that Nanaya-Ilai and her daughter had been granted to a temple and the group was conducting business on its behalf. But in context, I think it's probably more likely that Nanaya-Ilai and her daughter had been granted to a contingent of men from Ashur, that group of 10 sellers I mentioned earlier, as part of their booty from a campaign in Elam. Assyrians fulfilled their service duties to the state in groups of 10, called a kisru, or knot, and the group in question is listed by their usual professions on the tablet. They included a baker, a weaver, a cook, a shepherd, an ironsmith, and a goldsmith, some of whom worked for a local temple. But the fact that they had these professions didn't absolve them of duties to their king. These men likely participated in some way, probably as part-time soldiers, in one of the last and most devastating acts of the Assyrian Empire. The shocking, even by Assyrian standards, sack and destruction of the Elamite capital of Susa in 646 BC. Nanaya-Ilai and her daughter had been taken captive during this campaign. and the document we have is a precious window onto the lives of people who would otherwise have been completely forgotten. Lanaya Ila'i almost certainly wasn't this woman's original name. Lanaya Ila'i means the goddess Nanaya is my deity, but not in the Elamite language that she would have spoken. It was common practice for deportees to choose a new name in their new homes, but in this case, Lanaya Ila'i was probably given her name by her new masters. She didn't choose it. The name is almost certainly a reference to a highly publicized event that took place during the sack of Susa, in which the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal returned a looted statue of the goddess Nanaya from Susa to its original home in the city of Uruk. We have no idea what Lanaya Ila'i would have called herself, nor her daughter, or even exactly how old her daughter was. Neo-Assyrian sale documents of this kind have a specific vocabulary for describing the ages of enslaved children. Since those terms of the milk, of the breast, or separated, meaning weaned, weren't used, we know that she was older than a toddler, but not old enough to be separated from her mother at the time of sale. Keeping enslaved children with their mother was a common enough practice at the time, and the price Manuki Ashur paid for Lanaya Ila'i and her daughter was roughly average for the time. Then, when the transaction was carried out, Manuki Ashur seems to have entrusted the sale document to a family of scribes for safekeeping in their archive. Reading between the lines of this rather unremarkable-seeming text, it's one of many hundreds or more likely thousands of these sale documents found in Neo-Assyrian sites, we can see the outlines of a remarkable story. Lanaya Ila'i and her daughter were taken captive during the orgy of violence that accompanied the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal's invasion of Susa. They then made the long journey to Ashur, probably walking around 800 kilometers or 500 miles. Finally, Lanaya Ila'i and her daughter were sold for cash, presumably because it was hard to divide their labor 10 ways among the group of soldiers who owned them. The money was distributed to the baker, weaver, cook, shepherd, ironsmith, goldsmith, and whoever else wasn't named. Lanaya Ila'i and her daughter joined the household of Manuki Ashur, and they disappear from the historical record. Perhaps they died shortly afterward, worn out by their experiences and the long journey. Or perhaps they survived, maybe for long enough to see the city of Ashur itself fall victim to what it had for so long meted out to others. We'll come back to that. Here's how a tablet of Ashurbanipal describes his campaign to Susa. Quote, "Susa, the great holy city, abode of their gods, seat of their mysteries, I conquered. I entered its palaces, I opened their treasuries where silver and gold, goods and wealth were amassed. I destroyed the ziggurat of Susa. I smashed its shining copper horns. I reduced the temples of Elam to naught. Their gods and goddesses I scattered to the winds. The tombs of their ancient and recent kings I devastated. I exposed to the sun, and I carried away their bones toward the land of Ashur. I devastated the provinces of Elam, and on their lands I sowed salt." Now compare that, the description that's far more likely to end up in a textbook account of Assyria, to what we've learned about Lanaya Ila'i and her daughter. If we want to truly understand both empires in general and the Assyrian Empire in particular, we need to be able to consider it from both of those perspectives.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths, and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When Lanaya Ila'i and her daughter arrived in Ashur after their long journey, they were entering the spiritual heart of the Assyrian Empire. Asher was no longer the capital and hadn't been for more than two centuries. That honor had gone first to the purpose-built city of Kalu, briefly to Sargon II, city of Dur-Sharrukin, and then finally to Nineveh, where it remained until the end of the empire. But Ashur always remained central to the Assyrians. That's because Ashur wasn't really a city. Ashur was a god, and the city was the physical embodiment of Ashur, especially the craggy spike of rock that towered over the River Tigris. The territory we call Assyria was to them Mat-Ashur, the land of Ashur, and the king was Ashur's human agent. We often use terms like patron deity to describe gods like Ashur, but that's not actually the case here. There was simply no distinction, no boundary between the god, the city, and his extended territory. Ashur physically resided in his temple in the city, a massive and ever-expanding complex of buildings, but he wasn't alone. Over time, gods from elsewhere, or at least their statues, but again, there was no distinction between those, came to live with Ashur. They were effectively held as divine hostages, submitting in person to the overwhelming power of Ashur and his human servants. If even their gods had been overcome and moved to Ashur's home, who were mere people to refuse Ashur's domination? If we want to understand the Assyrian Empire and why its kings behaved the way they did, and made hundreds of thousands or millions of people like Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter suffer, then we need to grasp their conception of empire. Empire is not a self-evident thing. Armies don't form themselves, march out on campaigns of tremendous scale, and create geographically extensive states on a whim. They certainly don't do it repeatedly over the course of many centuries, without reasons for doing so that made good sense to them. It's easy to point to the material inducements, like more land, plunder, slaves, and simple lust for power, but there's also an underlying ideology that justifies kings and their subordinates acting in this manner. In the Assyrian case, this justification came from Ashur. The 9th century BC king Ashurnasirpal put it like this, quote, "When Ashur, my great god, had called me by name and made my sovereignty supreme over the kings of the four quarters, he placed his merciless weapon in my lordly hands and sternly commanded me to rule, subdue, and direct the lands and mighty highlands." Ashur wasn't the only deity who mattered. Ishtar, present in both Arbela and Nineveh and responsible for both love and war, was another important one, but no other god embodied Assyria in the way that Ashur did. Different kings of Assyria paid homage to Ashur in varying degrees, and their repetitions of these themes could be pretty formulaic, but the underlying ideas remained the same. Ashur was king of the gods, his city was the center of an ordered universe, and it was the king's primary job to extend Assyrian authority, and thus Ashur's divine order, as far as possible. This wasn't unique to the Assyrians. They got the idea, including the sense of the world as civilization on the plains surrounded by barbarous mountains, from prior ages of Mesopotamian rulership. Where the Assyrians differed was in the wholesale equation of the god with the city, with his extended territory, and the vehemence of the king's duty to extend Ashur's divine order as far as possible. The god commanded, and they obeyed. Ashur's support was necessary for success in these campaigns, and kings had to constantly seek to understand Ashur's needs and wants through divination and oracles. Portents written in the heavens were particularly important, and we have some seriously complex letters between Assyrian kings and their astronomers debating precisely how to make a planned campaign conform to the observed omens. Every account of a campaign began with a formulaic phrase, "Ina tukulti Ashur u ilani rabuti," meaning having received positive assurance from Ashur and the other great gods. It might be formulaic, but the idea is absolutely essential. None of this happened without Ashur's approval. He was the god, the statue, the crag of rock, the city in which it stood, but also the territory as a whole, and only his will and his power could extend it. By behaving correctly, the kings ensured his support, and Ashur's support meant certain victory for Assyria's armies. Upon completion of a successful campaign, the kings often composed a letter that would be sent to Ashur in his eponymous city, along with a detailed report of what had transpired. Communication went both ways. Now, it wasn't enough to do Ashur's will away from home. The god, who physically lived within his vast temple complex in the city of Ashur, had to be provided for by his human worshippers. Clothing, because the god's statue had to be dressed in the finest garments, luxury goods, and enslaved people all flowed into the temple on a regular basis. So did food, because the god had to eat and Ashur consumed a whole feast every day. This was all in keeping with long-standing practices in the Near East. But where the Assyrians differed was in turning the obligation to provide for Ashur into a facet of imperial domination. Staple foods were easy to come by, and the Assyrians could have simply designated the produce of a particular estate to provide Ashur with the sheep, cattle, poultry, barley, wheat, sesame, honey, fruits, and figs he demanded. But they didn't do that. Instead, the obligation to feed Ashur was spread around to the various provinces of the empire. A few cattle might travel all the way from Assyrian-controlled territory in central Turkey, sheep from near Babylon, and wheat from Syria in quantities that fit no economic or commercial logic, but which made perfect ideological sense. The Assyriologist Karen Radner sums it up like this, quote, "All subjects of Ashur had to participate jointly in the care for the god. In this way, the realm was defined as the community of Ashur's worshippers. Conversely, the refusal to provide for the god's meal was considered an act of treason. Even people living far away from the center of the Assyrian Empire, that core triangle with Ashur at one point, were tied to the core by the god and his demands." Ashur was in charge, but the king was his agent, and he acted for an audience. The people of Assyria, like the group of 10 men who had probably received Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter as spoils of war, and their families back home in the city of Ashur. How did the king reach them? The Assyriologist Mario Liverani, the reigning expert on Neo-Assyrian imperial ideology, sums up the relationship like this. The king made an ongoing habit of what we might call imperial display, which took a variety of forms. I mentioned the letter to the god Ashur that king sent to the city, and most Assyriologists have argued that these letters were read aloud to the people of the city. This presumably happened at the end of a triumphal parade when the returning army marched through the streets, carrying with them the plunder they'd acquired on their campaign. Defeated kings and other notable captives were publicly humiliated and sometimes tortured and executed in full view of the crowd. Prisoners like Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter were probably forced to participate in this spectacle. This is how they caught their first glimpses of their new home, as part of a procession of defeated enemies, their ears ringing with the jeers and cheers of the people of Ashur. Bearded faces framed by shoulder-length hair called out to them from the crowd. They couldn't understand the words, but their meaning, and the place of Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter in this new home, were clear. When the people of Ashur looked at the triumphal parade, at the long line of people like Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter, they were seeing the living embodiment of the imperial message that constantly surrounded them. Ashur was victorious thanks to the worship they gave the god, and they were rewarded for their piety. They saw that message on carved stone reliefs, stone monuments, in palaces, and temples. One carved relief at Ashurbanipal's palace in Nineveh portrays the king sitting in an idyllic garden with the severed head of the Elamite king, Nanaya Ila'i's king, hanging from a tree nearby. Assyrians heard that message read aloud in the letter to the god Ashur that I mentioned, and in other royal proclamations. Maybe they would occasionally see a depiction of dead Assyrians, and they certainly knew or knew of men who didn't return home from the constant military campaigns. But their experience was one of a constantly victorious Ashur and the state devoted to him. The part-time state servants who were granted ownership of Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter weren't just consumers of imperial propaganda, though. They were participants in the Assyrian imperial project, and they directly benefited from it. In their daily lives, they might have been a baker, a weaver, a cook, a shepherd, an ironsmith, a goldsmith, and whatever unlisted occupations the other five members of the 10-man group had. When they left Ashur at the call of their king and headed south to visit devastation on Elam, they became something else. When Ashurbanipal described Assyrian destruction and plundering in Elam using the first-person I, he wasn't actually talking about his own actions. He was talking about things that men like those 10, the owners of Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter, had done far away from home. Assyria had professional soldiers who were members of permanent military units, but plenty more regular folks served in the king's armies as well. It wasn't just a separate military class that was so intimately involved in the destruction that Assyria wrought over the centuries, but normal, everyday people like the baker, weaver, cook, shepherd, ironsmith, goldsmith, and the others. That was even more true early in Assyria's imperial history, when its entire military force was composed of part-time soldiers like these. They were the ones who carried out massacres and dragged women and children out of their homes and into a life of slavery, who smashed the statues of the gods and burned down villages and wrecked temples. The empire that Assyria built benefited its kings and elites, of course, and obviously they picked and chose where their armies went. They got to build palaces and mansions, own huge tracts of land, have monuments erected in their honor, and wield power on a scale that's hard for us to imagine. But they weren't the only people in Assyria who gained at the expense of the conquered. In return for Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter, each member of that 10-man Kisru directly received about 50 grams of silver, 5 or 6 shekels, which was a considerable sum of money, anywhere between 2 and 6 months' wages for a worker. They probably had their own personal plunder from the campaign as well, in addition to any wages they received. That's leaving aside the royal infrastructure projects from which they benefited, the hired work they received from temples that had been granted war spoils. 5 of the 10 listed in the sale document worked for a temple. The opportunity to go on trading missions made possible by Assyrian imperial activity. And last but not least, benefiting from the labor of thousands upon thousands of people like Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter, who had been forcibly brought to the Assyrian heartland. It would be a mistake, I think, to blame Assyria's kings and the god they represented alone for the blood-soaked actions of Assyrian conquest and completely absolve the everyday people of Ashur. They may not have left us the dramatic first-person texts recording their brutal deeds like the kings, but the kings weren't the ones wielding flaying knives, cutting off heads, or doing the everyday work of conquest. Ashurbanipal may have been ultimately responsible, but his soldiers had carried out his orders to the letter while he sat in the palace of the Elamite kings in Susa. Men every bit as normal and nondescript, people who wouldn't have stood out in a crowd at all, as the baker, weaver, cook, shepherd, ironsmith, and goldsmith had smashed the cult images, desecrated the ancient bones in Susa's royal tombs, cut down the sacred groves of trees, set fire to residential neighborhoods, and salted the fields so nothing would grow. Most of all, Ashurbanipal wasn't the man who had broken into houses to round up prisoners, dragging off people like Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter into a life of slavery. They would never see their home again.
If you travel for work, you know to pack 2 suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/business.
Whatever their involvement in the sharp end of imperial expansion, the Assyrian Empire in the middle of the 7th century BC was full of normal people. As Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter tramped northward on their way from their devastated home in Elam to Ashur, they passed through the rich, fertile lands of recently conquered Babylonia. Orchards of fruit trees and date palms crowded around the banks of the 2 great rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, while regular patterns of irrigation canals brought life-giving water to the endless fields of grain that fed the region's many cities. Like Elam, Babylonia too had recently suffered the depredations of Assyria's armies. 2 years prior to the destruction of Susa and the rest of the Elamite kingdom, Babylon itself had fallen after a lengthy siege and Assyria's armies ran amok. Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter must have seen burned-out villages, knocked-down walls, and if they passed through Babylon itself, much of the great city lying in ashes. The Assyrian soldiers shepherding Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter northward must have noticed the looks of displeasure on the faces of many Babylonians as they traveled through the country, sullen stares and glares of outright hatred. This was a conquered land, one that had been treated only slightly less brutally than Elam, and its inhabitants weren't about to forgive and forget. Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter left Babylonia behind, probably traveling north along the Tigris River, and soon entered the Assyrian heartland. The people they encountered in the highly productive fields and orchards in the countryside weren't all Assyrians in the sense that they and their ancestors had lived in this region. A great many of them had been moved to their new homes by the Assyrian state as deportees. The Assyrian Empire moved enormous numbers of people, thousands of them at a time, and a minimum of about 1.5 million in total over 2 centuries within its borders. They did so for 2 reasons. First, in order to prevent potential rebellions before they happened by eliminating group ties to their homelands. And second, to maximize the productivity of the available agricultural land by literally moving workers onto it and teaching them the most effective techniques, especially artificial irrigation, beekeeping, and the production of valuable crops like flax, wine, olive oil, and fruit. Though these weren't genocidal death marches because the Assyrians highly valued the deportees' labor, they didn't have any choice about this. The scale was truly staggering. A generation before, in the night Ela'i and her daughter moved north, the king Sennacherib had moved 500,000 people, many of them to his new capital city of Nineveh. Esarhaddon, Ashurbanipal's predecessor, had transported thousands of people from as far away as Egypt to the rest of the empire, preferring highly skilled craftspeople, specialists, and scholars. Ashurbanipal had done so as well, though on a smaller scale. The result was that the Assyrian Empire was far more homogeneous than we might expect from such a large state. That was especially true linguistically. Deportees and prisoners tended to adopt the Aramaic language, the empire's lingua franca, for both speaking and writing. Their new neighbors, after all, wouldn't have known a word of the deportees' native languages, whether that was Egyptian, Hebrew, Elamite, or one of the dozens of other tongues spoken in such a large and diverse space. The Assyrian heartland would have been home to Babylonians, Hurrians from Urartu to the north, Aramaeans, Egyptians, Medes from western Iran, and many, many more, all of them brought to the center by the actions of empire. Some transplanted communities retained aspects of their native cultures for generations. Others became indistinguishable from their neighbors in just a few years. Nanaya Ela'i and her daughter were enslaved, not deportees, but they would have been expected to assimilate to this homogenous imperial culture after their arrival in Ashur. A quick note here, for what follows, I'm relying on Karen Radner's chapter in A Companion to Assyria entitled Economy, Society, and Daily Life in the Neo-Assyrian Period. Ashur was no longer Assyria's capital, and the ambitious and power-hungry tended to view it as a backwater in comparison to the massive city of Nineveh, where imperial authority truly resided. But Ashur was still a thriving city. The Temple of Ashur was a massively wealthy and powerful institution that dominated life in the city. A large proportion of the city's population worked for the temple in some capacity as craftspeople or administrators. Others worked as city officials or in the households of members of the royal family who maintained houses in Ashur. But others followed the age-old occupation of Ashur, one that had dominated it since it enters the historical record a millennium before: trade. Ashur had been home to wide-ranging merchants for more than 1,000 years, and that hadn't changed in the slightest. We know from the cuneiform records found in the city that Ashur remained home to well-traveled, prosperous merchants right up until the end of its existence. One of these merchants, a man named Duri Ashur, has left behind a significant archive of texts related to his trading company. Duri Ashur probably lived not too far from the Naya Ela'i and her daughter, and her owner ran a household of similar size and scope. He may even have had a trading business as well. Duri Ashur's house was about 150 square meters, about 1,600 square feet in size, and it would have included the merchant himself, his immediate family, and household servants like Naya Ela'i and her daughter. That wasn't a mansion, and it would have felt a bit cramped with so many people living in it, but that was pretty sizable in a really densely built-up city. We have to imagine that house as a bustling place, with people constantly coming and going on errands and business, bringing in food and cooking, washing and cleaning, breaking pottery, and the constant din of voices. Not all of those voices spoke Assyrian or even Aramaic. Duri Ashur's neighbors, for example, were Egyptian. Unlike many merchants, Duri Ashur wasn't much of a traveler. He had partners in his trading firm, and they were the ones who accompanied the firm's goods and its hired agents on their journeys away from the city. According to Duri Ashur's records, these trading missions took place 3 times per year. The traveling partners and hired agents led a train of donkeys northward along the Tigris River, laden with clothing, textiles, and silver, and returned home with wine packed in sheep or goatskins for transport on rafts down the Tigris. Duri Ashur and his partners accepted investments from all sorts of people in the city, even tiny sums of money, a fraction of a shekel. Remember, Nanaya Ela'i and her daughter were sold for 60 shekels. This wasn't a huge enterprise, but it was profitable, and Duri Ashur stayed in business for more than 35 years. More important than this single business was the fact that Ashur was full of trading firms like it, some bigger, some smaller, each of which had its own specific trade routes and products. Some specialized in the slave trade, particularly from Anatolia to the west. Another surviving archive relates to a family trading company that had roots in western Iran, and that was mostly where they continued to do business. We have no idea how long Nanaya Ela'i and her daughter lived after their sale in Ashur or exactly what their lives were like. We can be sure that they were at the very bottom of the social hierarchy, perhaps wearing crude sackcloth, since that term appears to be synonymous with low status. They probably stayed together, at least for a while. It wasn't unheard of for families of enslaved people to be separated, but it wasn't a common occurrence either. Perhaps Nanaya Ela'i married an enslaved man. This would have pleased her owner, since any children born to their union would likewise have become his property, and some Neo-Assyrian documents show owners actively trying to create enslaved families in their households. Whether encouraged or not, enslaved people did have their own relationships, they did have children, and they carried on their own society. But it's hard to see enslaved people in Neo-Assyrian sources. While sale documents like the one we have for Nanaya Ela'i and her daughter show up regularly, the vocabulary used to describe laborers doesn't strongly distinguish between low-status workers in general and enslaved people in particular. Perhaps they changed hands when their owner died, or they were sold to another owner, the transaction recorded in a document that simply hasn't survived. However they were treated and whatever path they took, it's unlikely that Nanaya Ela'i and her daughter were ever formally freed. There are no Neo-Assyrian manumission documents, and their language didn't have terms for freedman or freedwoman, unlike the slightly later Babylonians. Let's assume that Nanaya Ela'i and her daughter lived long, if not happy, lives in Ashur after their sale. Nanaya Ela'i aged and became elderly, worn down by a lifetime of hard work. Her daughter grew into adulthood, perhaps marrying another enslaved person and having children of her own, much to her owner's delight. They wouldn't have noticed much change as the decades passed on, with caravans like those of Duri Ashur and the other merchants of the city leaving and returning on a regular basis. But perhaps as they were out and about running errands or collecting water or socializing with other low-status people, they heard rumblings about the mounting trouble elsewhere in Assyria's vast empire. Ashurbanipal, the bane of the Babylonians and Elamites, whose armies had wrecked Babylon and Susa and dragged Nanaya Ela'i and her daughter back to Ashur and a life of slavery, reigned for more than 30 years. In many ways, his reign marked the high point of the Assyrian Empire. But that was far more the case for the first two-thirds of his reign than its end. We know very little about what he did, if anything, in the last decade he sat on the throne. And by the time he stepped down as king, sometime between 631 and 627 BC, the end was closer than anybody could have imagined. The outline of events is hazy, but it seems clear that confusion followed Ashurbanipal's death. An insurrection of some kind broke out in Ashur, which the now aged Nanaya Ela'i and her daughter would have seen firsthand. It took 4 years before a new king firmly established himself on the Assyrian throne, and by that time, it was too late. Babylonia had by this point been firmly under Assyrian control for two decades, but with the Assyrians busy elsewhere, a new king seized power in the south. Nabopolassar, probably a member of a high-ranking family in Uruk, who acted quickly to throw off Assyrian domination. The Assyrians responded by repeatedly invading Babylonia to deal with the threat, and for an entire decade from 626 to 616 BC, Nabopolassar and the Assyrians fought battle after battle and siege after siege. The Assyrians enlisted allies from the far corners of their empire, ranging from Egypt to northwestern Iran, but in the end, Nabopolassar united Babylonia against Assyria and invaded Assyria itself. He laid siege to Ashur in 615 BC, but was forced to retreat southward. Nanaya Ela'i and her daughter must have breathed a sigh of relief, but their relief was short-lived. In the following year, 614 BC, another army showed up outside Ashur, belonging not to the Babylonians, but to the Medes, longtime foes of the Assyrians from western Iran. They sacked and burned Ashur to the ground, looting and destroying, carrying off plunder and prisoners. Perhaps Nanaya Ela'i and her daughter survived the destruction, escaping to the countryside or hiding somewhere in the city to avoid the rampaging Medes. It would be wonderful to think that perhaps they got away entirely, leaving behind their lives of slavery. But they couldn't return home. Elam no longer existed. Nanaya Ela'i was too old to make a journey that long without help, and her daughter couldn't have remembered her childhood language even if they could have made the journey. The Assyrians had taken all of that from them, and the past was gone. In a more likely scenario, perhaps they were once again carried off into captivity, this time to the east in Media, enslaved once more. Either way, they must have witnessed terrible things, not once but twice in their lifetimes. The end of a city could only be horrific. For centuries, the Assyrians had visited that fate on others. Now they, and those they had forced to become part of their society, like Nanaya Ela'i and her daughter, would experience it themselves. The loss of Ashur was only the beginning of Assyria's woes. Just 2 years later, in 612 BC, Nineveh itself fell to the Medes and Babylonians. Thanks to excavations at one of the city's gates, known as the Halsey Gate, recorded in a 2005 paper by Diana Pickworth, we can get a sense for the frenzied violence that accompanied the city's end. More than a dozen skeletons were found packed into the narrow passageway. many had obviously met their deaths at the hands of Medes or Babylonians there. One adult man had been stabbed repeatedly in the back, another had been hacked down with a sword blow to the head, a 12 or 13-year-old boy had been stabbed repeatedly in the face, and several people had been shot with bronze and iron arrows. In the end, the whole gate was set on fire with half a dozen living people still inside, including children. The structure collapsed, crushing and burning them to death. Their bodies remained there for the next 2,600 years. Maybe the same fate met Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter at their end 2 years earlier in Ashur, yet another traumatic event in lives filled with hardship and sadness. That was the fate of Assyria. The Medes and Babylonians didn't just sack Nineveh and Ashur, they completely destroyed them, burning and pulling down buildings and destroying temples and royal tombs. In other words, they followed the Assyrian template set down during the long and brutal reign of Ashurbanipal, the precise blueprint that had forced Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter and so many others into lives of slavery. The Babylonians and Medes who carried out these horrific acts, no less horrific than what the Assyrians had inflicted on them for generations, had learned from their oppressors. In the end, the Assyrians reaped what they had sown for so long. Innocent people like Nanaya Ila'i and her daughter paid the price for imperial glory, as they always do. Next time on Tides of History, we're going to leave the destruction of Assyria behind and head to the west to catch a glimpse of the emergence of a new world, an interconnected Mediterranean. We'll take a tour of that Mediterranean world as it came to exist around 600 BC, the time when Assyria was destroyed, after centuries of Phoenician and Greek trade and colonization had united it into a single unit reaching all the way to the Atlantic. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. I've also written a book called The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It's available now on hard copy, paperback, ebook, or audiobook that I read, of course, from your distributor of choice. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman, sound designed by Derek Behrens for Airship, audio editing by Molly Bach for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.